We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than from others in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the life growing inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she'll choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing truth. Friend, this is not a time to be silent. It's a time for courage, for truth, for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and life. Donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250, baby. Or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Mark Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. It is Thanksgiving. So much to be thankful for. I don't even know where to start. Actually, I do know where to start. I'm going to actually read a Thanksgiving proclamation to you that was given by the Continental Congress in 1777. So we're kind of at the point, this is November 1st, 1777. I mean, if you think about the context, I mean, we're just losing, battle after battle after battle. It's we had won it. I think Saratoga, finally had a victory, but mostly losing. And yet these men continue to fight. These families continue to sacrifice, and even in the midst of all that, continued to be thankful. So here's what our leaders, the people that declared independence and then continued to fight and continued to try to govern, tried to start a new nation. I mean, here's what they had to say with regard to being thankful for what God had done for us already, even in the midst of a war. So this is Saturday, November 1st, 1777. For as much as it is the indispensable duty of all men to adore the superintending providence of Almighty God, to acknowledge with gratitude their obligation to Him for benefits received, and to implore such farther blessings as they stand in need of, and it having pleased Him in His abundant mercy not only to continue to us the innumerable bounties of His common providence, but also smile upon us in the prosecution of a just and necessary war for the defense and establishment of our unalienable rights and liberties, particularly in that He hath been pleased in so great a measure to prosper the means used for the support of our troops and to crown our arms with most signal success. It is therefore recommended to the legislature or executive powers of these United States to set apart Thursday, the 18th day of December next, for solemn thanksgiving and praise, that with one heart and one voice the good people may express the grateful feelings of their hearts and consecrate themselves to the service of their divine benefactor, and that together with their sincere acknowledgments and offerings, they may join the penitent confession of their manifold sins, whereby they had forfeited every favor, and their humble and earnest supplication that it may please God through the merits of Jesus Christ mercifully to forgive and blot them out of remembrance, that it may please Him graciously to afford His blessings on the governments of these states respectively, and prosper the public council of the whole, to inspire our commanders both by land and sea and all under them with that wisdom and fortitude which may render them fit instruments under the providence of Almighty God to secure for these United States the greatest of all blessings, independence and peace, that it may please Him to prosper the trade and manufactures of these people and the labor of the husbandmen, that our land may yield its increase, to take schools and seminaries of education so necessary for cultivating the principles of true liberty, virtue, and piety under His nurturing hand, and to prosper the means of religion for the promotion and enlargement of that kingdom which consisteth in righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost, and it is further recommended that servile labor and such recreation as though at other times innocent may be unbecoming the purpose of this appointment be omitted on so solemn an occasion. Wow. What a bunch of atheist agnostics and deists, right? That was a joke. I mean, think about it. They're sitting there asking for forgiveness of their sins, thanking God for the ability to please him through the merits of Jesus Christ to forgive and blot out their sins. I mean, asking for God's blessing on everything from commerce to winning the war to the land, growing crops. I mean, come on, folks. That's an amazing Thanksgiving proclamation by the Continental Congress. So these are the founding fathers of America. In the Continental Congress in 1777, just a little over a year after declaring independence, and yet years away from victory against the British. I just love that. So powerful, and something to remind us of what the founders were thinking, how they thought. And then it didn't stop there. Before I jump back into biblical citizenship, let me read another one to you. This one is from this is actually from FDR. So here's a Democrat on Thanksgiving Day in 1944. And he said, in this year of liberation, which has seen so many millions freed from tyrannical rule, it is fitting that we give thanks with special fervor to our Heavenly Father for the mercies we have received individually and as a nation, and for the blessings he has restored through the victories of our arms and those of our allies to his children in other lands, for the preservation of our way of life from the threat of destruction, for the unity of spirit, which has kept our nation strong, for our abiding faith in freedom, and for the promise of an enduring peace. We should lift up our hearts in thanksgiving. For the harvest that has sustained us and in its fullness brought succor to other peoples, for the bounty of our soil, which has produced the sinews of war for the protection of our liberties and for a multitude of private blessings known only in our hearts, we should give united thanks to God. To the end that we may bear more earnest witness to our gratitude to Almighty God, I suggest a nationwide reading of the Holy Scriptures during the period from Thanksgiving Day to Christmas. Let every man of every creed go to his own version of the Scriptures for a renewed and strengthening contact with those eternal truths and majestic principles which have inspired such measure of true greatness as this nation has achieved. Wow. I mean, this is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States of America. And I just finished reading his closing. In consonance with the joint resolution of the Congress approved, do hereby proclaim Thursday, the 23rd day of November, 1944, a day of national thanksgiving, and I call upon the people of the United States to observe it by bending every effort to hasten the day of the final victory and by offering to God our devout gratitude for his goodness to us and to our fellow men. I mean, folks, come on. This is a Democrat president of the United States, FDR, in the middle of the war, calling on everybody to spend time between Thanksgiving and Christmas in the reading of the Holy Scriptures. In fact, he said a nationwide reading of the Holy Scriptures. I mean, that should tell you right there the kind of nation that America has been and can be again. But we got to rediscover those truths. So let's jump in to our biblical citizenship in modern America, where we left off on Tuesday. Got several more weeks of this. This is actually week four that we've been going through. There's 8 weeks total, and we're not going to get all that in, but we may get most of week four in today, and then pick up a little bit of week five, and then maybe we'll finish that out next Tuesday. Anyway, let's jump in. Here's where we left off on Tuesday. You're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America.
It's a red herring. You got to pick your battles. You got to fight the battles you can win. That's not one we're going to be able to win. I don't like income tax. I'll just be honest with you. I'm a fair tax guy. I think the only fair tax is when you're spending your money, you pay a sales tax. I don't like getting punished for making money, and I don't like getting punished for investing in my home. So as my property value increases, I get punished for that. I think those are bad taxes. Fair tax is a sales tax. But it is the law of the land. And as long as it's the law of the land, I got to obey the law while I fight to change the law. I'd love to amend the Constitution and get rid of the income tax. But trust me on this. Don't join these groups that say you don't have to pay your income tax. It's optional. All the kind of, trust me on that. It is much easier to fight City Hall from outside the prison walls. so don't. And if you doubt me on that one, I'll get you Wesley Snipes' phone number. You can call Wesley and ask him how he enjoyed those days in jail for not paying his income tax. Pay your income tax, and then let's work to change it. And the 16th actually didn't give the federal government the right to tax income. What it did was it changed it from having to be apportioned evenly among the state. It made it easier, is what happened, and it made it so easy. In fact, you might recall people saying, well, originally they were going to cap it at 1% or 2% or 3%. And they talked, and it said, it'll never get that high. Well, now we know obviously it's a lot higher than that. I wish they had put some sort of cap on it. But it is what it is. You remember earlier when I said the 17th Amendment was the second worst amendment to the Constitution? Can anybody guess what I think the worst amendment to the Constitution? Yeah, 16th Amendment. So imagine this. It was done in 1913 as well. What were those people in 1913 smoking, man? I mean, they really messed up our Constitution. But it is what it is. Maybe over time we can get it changed and get rid of the income tax and go to sales tax. I think it would work a lot better, and I certainly think it would be much more fair. Last two, I used to just run right through these, run over them, and not even talk about them. 18th and 21st, to drink or not to drink. The 18th Amendment, of course, prohibition. 21st, repealing that. I used to fly through it, and then the guy that we're working on tonight, my caller, he gives me a stop. I was flying through it on a radio program with him. I was interviewing him on Wall Builders Live, and I flew through the 18th and 21st, and he says, Rick, wait, stop. You're missing a great lesson here. I said, what? They cancel each other out. I just blew by it. And he said, no, look. He said, why did the 18th Amendment have to be adopted? We had a national epidemic. Everybody said, alcohol has become a real problem. The people said it's something we haven't been able to deal with in the states. We want the federal government involved to help us with this problem. Why didn't the feds just do it? Why did you need an amendment to the Constitution for the feds to go help with this problem? Because they didn't have the power to do it. Because we understood, and this is what Mike was trying to get me to see, we understood that the only thing you could, only time you could add a power to the federal government and let them do something new is if we the people amended the Constitution. And so the 18th and the 21st actually stand as glaring examples, wonderful precedent, that if we want the federal government to do something new that's not authorized, as we'll see in Article 1, Section 8, then we the people have to add it to their powers. And he said, we did that with the 18th Amendment. We said, you know what, we want you to help with this. And Congress knew as well. That's the other part of that story. Not only did we the people know that they're not supposed to do that without our permission, but Congress knew they couldn't do it, and so they adopted the amendment and sent it home to the states to be ratified. We ratified it. We said, we want you to do this. And then we said, this ain't working out so well. And so we went back with the 21st Amendment, and if you think about it, we talked about earlier how we loan power to the government, and we can take it back at any time. We loan the power to the federal government to ban alcohol. When we took that power back, we didn't take all of it back. We left them the power to regulate it. So the language still gives them the ability to regulate it. They just couldn't ban it anymore. But what a great reminder for us that the things that they do have to come from us first. We have to give them permission. But today what happens when the people say, or Congress just decides they want to do something new? They just pass a law and do it. They don't even look in Article 1, Section 8 and see if they actually have the power to do it. That's what we have to change. That's why we have to know what is it that they can do.
I was speaking in Iowa week before the session started in 2017, actually speaking on federalism. And I was sick. I wanted to get home. The legislative session was about to start. I get to the airport and freezing rain. So sit on the airport grounds, everything. We're sitting on the plane. I'm thinking, man, I got to transfer through Minneapolis. I got to get home. The legislative session's going to start. Finally, we take off and we get there. And I'm trying to think, can I figure out a way to get to my gate and still make it, not be stuck in Minneapolis? And just as we're landing, I see this giant of a man, big, bright red University of Utah football t-shirt on. And I said, that guy's going where I'm going. I'm going back to Salt Lake. And I'm gonna follow that guy. I get off the plane, I grab my roller bag, I have my shoulder back. I'm just following that guy as fast as I can go, and he's just parting the crowd, just parting the sea, and off we go. I'm running to keep up with him. And we get to the gate just as the door's about to close, and they sit us together on the exit row. So then we start the little introduction, and he tells me he is the linebacker coach for the University of Utah, but he had played at BYU. And if you know Utah football, that's the holy war, BYU, Utah. And he says, well, what do you do? I said, well, I'm in the state legislature. And he says, well, what do you do? And I said, well, let me see if I can explain it this way. That holy war you just had a couple months ago, kind of a different game, right? And he says, yeah, it's a different game. So the whole week is different, right? The practice is different, preparation's different, media is different. The speech the coach gives on Saturday morning is different. You come running out of the tunnel and it's different. Stadium is packed and it's just electric and different. And imagine you get on the 50-yard and you're about ready to start that game and you're ready to face off that opponent and you buckle your chin strap and you look down and there are no lines on the field anywhere. He said, oh yeah, that'd be a disaster. I said, that's what the government's like today. There are no lines on the field. We don't know where to stand. We don't know the line of scrimmage. We don't know what a first down is anymore. We don't know what out of bounds is. We don't know what a touchdown is anymore. Our government was established with lines. In fact, Rick, James Wilson, very prominent, right? James Wilson was a signer of the Declaration, the Constitution, original member of the Supreme Court. He said, this Constitution deserves praise for the accuracy with which we drew the line between the powers of the state and national government.
That's a wrap on week four. We've already been diving into those principles. We've been getting the philosophy. We even got the 30,000 feet view of the entire Constitution. Next week, we're going to go deeper into the enumerated powers, the proper jurisdictions of government. What is it that our government under our Constitution actually can do, and how do we as citizens hold it accountable? That'll be next week on Biblical Citizenship in Modern America. We'll see you next week, guys. Well, okay, you don't have to wait till next week. You just have to wait through the break, okay? We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back, and we're going to start week five of Biblical Citizenship in Modern America, which means we're going to be diving even further into the Constitution and the biblical foundation of the Constitution. We're going to be talking about things we can do to make a difference. It's going to be a fantastic teaching, and I know that you're going to enjoy it. You know, we've had over 1 million people go through this course. We've had so many people take action after taking this course. So it really is an empowering program because you learn things you never knew. You get educated, but you also get inspired because you realize we can restore the country. So I encourage you to share this program today with your friends and family and sign up at PatriotAcademy.com to be a Constitution coach or host and invite your friends and family over to do this entire course, and it's entirely free. All right, quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
We're back here on At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there. If you missed the first segment, go listen to it online. I shared a couple of the Thanksgiving proclamations, one from the founding era in the Continental Congress in 1777, and then one from the last century in 1944 with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Both of those proclamations, fantastic. There's a ton more of those at Wallbuilders' website, wallbuilders.com, wallbuilders.com. In fact, if it's, you know, if you're sitting around and you haven't done this yet, I encourage you to look that up. Just pull it up on your phone, wallbuilders.com, search for Thanksgiving proclamation, and just pick any one. They've got, I think, 20 in there at least from over the years. And you can pick one of those and read it to the family over lunch or just gather them around in the living room. Read the one from Lincoln in 1863. Incredible thankfulness to God, even in the middle of a civil war. I mean, we think we got problems. Come on, folks. We can be thankful today. Anyway, those two proclamations in the first segment. Then we jumped into Biblical Citizenship in Modern America. We wrapped up the final part of week four, 8-week course, Biblical Citizenship in Modern America, most popular constitution class in the country for churches and faith groups, and over 1 million people have gone through it. It's really revolutionized the mindset of Christians with regard to this duty and the discipleship that is necessary on how to be a good citizen, actually making disciples, truly living out the Great Commission by making disciples. So this course is for you. I hope you will share it with your friends and family. I hope you'll watch the entire 8 weeks, and I hope you'll invite some people over when you do that, into your living room, your church, wherever it is. But it's all available for free right now at PatriotAcademy.com. It's PatriotAcademy.com. Just click on Biblical Citizenship when you get to that page. All right, we're going to jump into week five now. Week five, this is where we get a little bit further into the Constitution. You're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America on At the Core.
I think biblical citizenship as a Christian would be stewardship, that God has given us this republic to be stewards over.
And you begin to love what God loves and hate what he hates in the scriptures because your heart is lining up with the heart of God because of the gospel.
Well, and so many Christians are confused because they're being told things by from different people, such as, oh, Christians shouldn't do anything in government, stay out of that. It's not what the Bible says. In fact, we're called to be biblical citizens.
If you're a Christian, a person of faith, you must care about what's happening in our culture. You must get involved in voting.
Biblical principles are what produce freedom in society, but you won't have biblical principles in society in which you don't have citizens with a biblical worldview.
The further we move away from biblical principles, the further we move away from liberty and freedom.
As people are experiencing tyranny, they're asking why, what has happened, and there's just this feeling of being lost right now and not knowing where to turn. And you just gave us the foundation. This is truth. All right, we're here for week five of Biblical Citizenship in Modern America. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us for another week. You know, last week we did the Seeds of Liberty. We started talking about the philosophy of American government. We even did a 30,000-feet view of the Constitution. When we do the enumerated powers, when we really dive into the details of the Constitution, we're really going to begin to understand how this thing works. As we talk about on our radio program all the time, if we'll look at that biblical, historical, and constitutional perspective, then we can understand the right formula to put into our culture to get the benefits that we want. But we've got to know what that formula is, and we do that by studying. So we're going to head back to the Wall Builders Library and Museum, then we're going to go back into Independence Hall. It's time for us to really understand who has authority. With virtually every question of public policy, what's good for our neighborhoods, for our communities, our states, for our nation, we have to ask the question, who has authority? Who's going to make those decisions? What are those proper jurisdictional lines? Let's head back out to the Wall Builders Museum for week 5 of Biblical Citizenship. Welcome back to Constitutional Live with David Barton and Rick Green. It's time to get into the specifics. We're going to go through those specific enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, those powers given to Congress. But David, before we get to the specifics back in Philly and walk through them, when you think about the specifics and you think about all that you've learned from reading the Founding Fathers and their intent for these clauses in the Constitution, what's one that comes to mind that's really been changed from what they intended, distorted, even abused?
I think there's one that's abused by our folks that are pro-Constitution people, and they confuse a small government with a limited government. And there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah.
A limited government is what the Constitution established. And so when you think of a limited government, quite frankly, a limited government means it has certain jurisdictions. It's got certain lines it has to stay within. It doesn't have to do with the size. It has to do with what it can and can't do.
So it could be a lot of money, or it could be a big department.
That's right.
But it's within a certain jurisdiction.
That's right.
Because if you don't know what the limits of government are, then those that in government will exceed those. They will take away rights from you to increase their own power. You know, John Adams put it in perspective. He said, "Our Constitution is for religious and moral people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other." Why is that so important? Because the founders designed a government with limited power, a very small government, limited in size and scope and influence in your life. The only way that you can have a small, limited government is if you have a moral people, because moral people respect the rights of other people. And if it's an immoral society, they're more likely to violate the rights of others, which means you have to have more government to impose its will upon the people. And if you don't have the natural constraint of a populace that understands the limits of the government, then they will allow the government to take more power and take more of their rights to increase its size and power.
So if you look within the Constitution authorizes a military. Now, if you're going to have a military that will defend 330 million Americans here and abroad, it's not going
to
be small.
Yeah.
It's a limited government because it's limited to that military, but it's not a small area. The same, the Constitution says that the president can appoint ambassadors, can make treaties with foreign nations. That's why we have a State Department. That's one of the four original cabinet-level departments the Founding Fathers knew we needed. We got 257 embassies across the world. In the United States, we're one of 195 nations, and that goes up and down every year at the UN, but 257 embassies, that's not small. And that's not a small
budget.
So
your State Department's going to be big, but it hasn't crossed over those jurisdictional lines. It's still limited to the things we defined.
Post office. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress will establish post offices and post roads. We got 31,000 post offices because we have one in every community. That's not small, but it's limited. So that's limited government. And if we make the mistake of confusing limited government with small government, you get really frustrated and you won't understand it. Limited government means, hey, there's a certain set of lines you cannot cross. And those jurisdictional lines, and I'll give you a way this used to work, because we've already talked in previous programs about the six principles of the Declaration, one of which involved inalienable rights and moral laws. And one of the moral laws that we had dealt with the issue of marriage. Now, this is really easy to understand. Jesus has a quote out of Matthew 22:21. He says, "Render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, to God that which is God's." In other words, there are certain jurisdictions. This is not a separation church and state verse. There's certain, we talked earlier that, you know, you've got a gray Dodge pickup, I got a red Ford pickup, I want yours to be a red, so I go pay. I can't do that. I can do that which belongs to me. I can't do that which belongs to you.
There are certain areas of authority.
Certain areas of jurisdictional lines, and Caesar can't be a god. It can't get in. So Caesar's got to recognize those lines.
Yeah.
And And so what's with that? A good example of that is the marriage issue. Because if you take the marriage issue itself, back in Genesis 1 through 3, when God created everything, he said, this is good, this is good. But he got to man and woman and a family, he said, this is very good. And then Jesus has the same opportunity with his disciples, and they were asking about divorce, and specifically no-fault divorce, which is what the law allowed then. He said, hey guys, don't you remember how it was back at the beginning? He said, don't you remember that there was one man, one woman, and that's what God put together? And he said, what God's put together, let not man divide asunder. And so Jesus in that passage in Matthew 19 reaffirms that marriage is the lifelong union of a man and a woman. Okay, so that's God's definition. That is part of the moral law. That was actually part of the common law and the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution. This is enshrined in the Constitution through the common law. So you have that. Now what happens is in previous generations, government would never even think about redefining marriage because that's not part of its jurisdiction. It's already defined. God's already done that. There is something higher than government, that is God.
And, so government, it's not the government wouldn't have anything to do with marriage. It's their job to uphold it.
Their job
but
to uphold
it. But it would be outside. They'd be getting across those limited government jurisdictional lines if they started tinkering with it and changing the definition to be something it wasn't.
Let me take you to a court case that happened on this. 1913, the case is called Grigsby versus Reed. Actually, this is Supreme Court of Texas. And the question was, can we have civil unions? In other words, there's religious weddings or God weddings. Can we have secular weddings as well? Can we do a secular? I mean, you religious people do what you want to do, but we secular people. Here's what the court said, and real clear. They said marriage was not originated by human law. This is not something we came up with, therefore we don't have the right to regulate it. It says when God created Eve, she is a wife to Adam. They then and there occupied the status of husband to wife and wife to husband. It says the truth is that civil government has grown out of marriage, which created homes and population and society from which government became necessary. Marriages will produce a home and a family that will contribute to good society, to free and just government, and the support of Christianity. They said it would be sacrilegious to apply the designation a civil contract to such a marriage. It's that and more to status ordained by God. Now, this is a statement of jurisdiction. We can't go define that. It doesn't belong to us. I can't go paint your pickup red. It's not mine. Government says, hey, these are areas we can't get into. There's a higher authority here, and we recognize that as the laws of nature and nature's God, and we can't redefine the laws of nature and nature's God. That's limited government.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a government that says, you know, I recognize there's certain lines I can't cross. And that's why, again, the first premise of the Declaration is there is a creator. If there's nothing higher than government, the government thinks it's God and it will redefine anything it wants
to. Let me ask you a quick question. If you back up there, okay, so marriages will produce a home and family that will contribute to good society, to free and just government, and the support of Christianity. So that tells me then that marriage is something that government should be interested in because it's going to benefit the nation. It promotes it.
And see what it said? About it will contribute to good society. Among other things I've done, I've been a consultant in the U.S. Justice Department. And we know, for example, that when you look specifically at all violent crime committed in America between 1973 and 1995, 90% of that violent crime came from kids who were raised in a home without a father and a mother.
Yeah.
So, all right, how much money do we spend on violent crime from that period, those 22 years?
And how much did it hurt other people? You didn't have a good society because people are being
harmed. You not only have the cost, you have the injuries and the loss of life and the loss of property that came from it. Plus, we know that the same group of kids raised in a situation without a mother and a father, that they're about 5 times more likely to have educational problems, about 4 times more likely to have psychological problems, about 3 times more likely to have health problems. So if we want to keep the cost of health care down, we need to have strong families. See, government could look at this from a totally secular viewpoint and say,
this is in our best interest
and what we're going to do. And so we've reached a point now where that as you look at out-of-wedlock births, for example, single-parent out-of-wedlock births, we have one program alone in America that spends $26.5 billion every year just to help teenagers who are still in high school but have babies while they're in high school, and we're having to pay for that. There's a number of nations across the world that have adopted homosexual or same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see from those nations over in Europe that have now had it for much longer than America has, they found that the average homosexual marriage lasted 18 months. And in that 18 months, it involved 9 extramarital partners.
Wow.
So if you're in one of those countries and you look at that and say, that's marriage, that doesn't mean much. So what they have found is in those countries, out-of-wedlock births have increased over 60%. So now they're paying a huge social economic cost.
It's affecting society.
Because it's affecting good society and free and just government, because now, since you can't control yourself anymore, you're not raised in an environment where you've been taught to control yourself, we have to control you with more police and more regulations and more laws and more.
Because so we as a society have an interest in this.
We
this
have
is,
an interest.
This is not a, because you know, sometimes I'll hear people say, well, government just should stay out of it completely, but we can't because government has an interest and does have a jurisdiction in promoting and supporting marriage as defined by God.
And that's part of the wrong argument. Government shouldn't get involved in moral issues. I'm sorry, point number four in the Declaration says it's a law of nature and nature's God. Yeah. That is a fixed moral law. That's what we incorporate in the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution. There are fixed moral laws. We do tell you what's right and wrong.
And every law you pass has a moral aspect to it.
It does.
Somebody's deciding, your representatives are deciding from a moral point of view to do something or not do something, to outlaw something
like
or make something
limits.
Legal.
Every time we pass a speed limit law that says we think it is moral to drive 55 or below, we think it's immoral to drive 55. Every law establishes a right and wrong. And John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration, says every law establishes a moral standard because we've said it's right or it's wrong. If it's wrong, we're going to punish you for it. That's morality.
That's legislative morality.
That's legislative morality.
Okay, I got you off track. Sorry about that. But that's the first time that it hit me about that in terms of there is a government role here.
There's a great
way of looking at it because it affects society.
It does affect it. Now, one of the interesting things is when you understand limited government, as you're going to talk about even in this session coming up, there's ways that that has been expanded. And one of those is the general welfare clause.
Yeah, talk about an abused clause from the Constitution. Yeah.
We can claim anything is for your general welfare. We in the government have decided that you need to have red hair, whatever. And so government can claim general welfare as whatever they want to do for anybody.
Right. It's opened it up to anything. You hear congressmen all the time say, well, the general welfare clause gives us authority to do this, and this is for the general welfare of the nation. But is that what these guys, when we go back to the original intent of the folks that gave us the Constitution, how did they mean it?
Even go back to recent debates in American history, debates over are there companies that are too big to fail?
Yeah.
Should federal government bail out companies that are too big to fail because it's going to destroy the economy and that's going to hurt everybody and the general welfare of everybody is you don't want the economy going under. And so all this is going, we had the TARP bills and the stimulus bills and all these things that have happened. And interestingly, as we sit here in this library, this is a very actively used library.
This is not a museum type thing where all this stuff just sits here. You guys are always researching and writing new books and taking information, putting it online.
And we have people come through all the time. It is a museum of sorts, but it's a working library.
Yeah.
And so it's a working museum. And so I remember very distinctly in the middle of that TARP stimulus bailout kind of stuff as we were looking, oh my gosh, insurance is about to go under, real estate's about to go under, automotive industry is about to go under, banking's about to go, we got to bail them out because if they go under, it'll destroy all the jobs in America. And I got a call from three congressmen who were on the floor in the House during that extended debate. And I could hear the debate going in the background. They said, hey, you know, with all the stuff you've got, do you think the founding fathers had a position on whether the federal government should bail out private industries and whether there are private industries that are too big to fail?
Did they connect that dot from one company to the general welfare of the whole nation?
Right.
Really is what they're asking.
And that is because we're being told in Congress right now as we debate right now that this is for the general welfare and this is what the founders would want. And so I don't know. Went back and actually found in this book right here. Now this is LH Debates on the Constitution. This is a 5-volume set. This is the first ever publication of all the notes at the Constitutional Convention. So a lot of people kept notes. You had Yates and you had King and other folks who kept notes. Luther Martin, all these delegates kept notes. They're all here. Madison, this is the first time Madison's notes in the mission come out. So in looking through here to see what they did, it turns out that
in fact, all those names you just named, you never hear those names. Madison's are the only one that anybody talks about, so you had a lot of them.
And there's a bunch of them, and they're here.
Quick break. Stay with me, folks. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. We're doing a little biblical citizenship in modern America, being thankful on this Thanksgiving Day for this incredible nation that he's given us.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach, and we will dive right back in where we left off before the break, listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America.
This is volume four of those volumes, and in this one, this is done and includes some of the later congressional debates that dealt with constitutional issues. And in the back of the book here is in volume four.
Let me ask you this. So what you're saying is these are the notes that the people that were actually debating the Constitution and adopting the Constitution made, and then added to that a lot of the same guys that were in that first Congress that are now debating that have to do with the Constitution. They added that because it's helping us understand.
Now we understand
how
intent.
The Constitution is supposed to work. Okay,
What you happen is in 1792, you have what's called the Codfish Bill. Now, here is the logic in 1792. You have Massachusetts. That is an economic engine that drives America. So much population out of Massachusetts, and you had Boston and Philadelphia and New York were your three big economic drive engines. Well, the really big one is Massachusetts. And what drives Massachusetts is the fishing industry. What drives the fishing industry is the codfish industry. And to this day, if you go in the Massachusetts chambers, their legislature, there's a big codfish hanging up there in the chambers because that was their economic backbone.
Yeah.
So there was a blight, if you will, on the codfish. Something was killing codfish, and they weren't able to get, like, kind of like when a red tide comes in and wipes everything out. And so here the economy of Massachusetts is headed down.
Because if they were hurt, if they were the main economic engine, it's hurt everybody else.
And that means that all these shipbuilders in South Carolina that build ships for Massachusetts, if there's no codfish,
it's going to affect a lot of people.
And so you look at all this stuff that's happened, and so Congress needs to step in. This is a general welfare. This company is too big to fail.
This is the AIG and all the other folks.
This is GM
of whatever year this was. Yeah.
And so all that's going on. And so that's progressing on the floor of Congress back in 1792. And James Madison, who one of the guys who signed the Constitution, one of the players there, one of the guys who really had a significant impact, he steps up, and it's interesting what he says about the general welfare, because he helped frame that clause in the Constitution. And he says, wait a minute, guys. He says, if you're going to use the general welfare clause to apply money to anything, he says, if Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare, and if they're the sole and the supreme judges of the general welfare, they may soon take the care of religion into their own hands. Hmm. It says they might appoint teachers in every state, county, and parish and pay them out of the public treasury. They might even take into their own hands the education of children, establishing in like manner schools throughout the Union. They might even assume the provision for the poor. They might undertake the regulation of all roads other than post roads. In short, everything from the highest object of state legislation down to the most minute object of police would be thrown under the power of Congress.
My parents worked hard to leave the legacy of America for my generation. And somewhere our generation decided that our baubles and our trinkets and our two jobs, dual income, being so busy and the barrenness of a busy life, that we would relegate the educating of our children to someone else, and we wouldn't even hold them accountable or attend those school boards or see what they're indoctrinating them with. So we just went after all the things. And now we look at it and go, what happened to the stuff we love? They've taken it. How did that happen?
He says, guys, if we don't stop this now, before long, Congress is going to get involved in education. They're going to get involved in the police powers. And the states are the ones that do, you know, it's interesting, even the police area. At the time of the Founding Fathers, there were only three felonies that were federal because they were listed in the Constitution. You had piracy and you had treason, etc. Now there's nearly 3,500 federal felonies.
So he's not saying that these things could happen and that's good. He's saying, if we go down this road, guys, this is bad.
If we go down this road, states are going to have nothing left.
Yeah.
And states are supposed to be in charge of education. Soon Congress will be. States are supposed to be the ones to deal with religion. Soon Congress will be dealing with religion.
All based on general welfare being distorted.
And so called these guys back on the floor of Congress, said, yep, codfish debate. Been there, done that. We've decided that the founders decided that the general welfare clause is never to be interpreted to say something's too big to fail and it has to be bailed. We talked in the very first session about how that they use general principles that are applicable across time.
Yeah.
And they had horses, no internet back then, but guess what? That principle is still as timeless today as it was 200 years
Whether
ago.
Whether it's cod fishing or AIG or
anything
any other
else,
big company.
It works. And so that's why, you know, going into this lesson on Article 1, what Congress can't do, or Congress can do, what they can't do is they can't use the general welfare clause to decide to take money that they collect from the states and give it back out for state functions.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go through these different phrases, these different clauses in Article 1, Section 8, and talk about what Congress can or can't do. And I still have a hard time believing that we're actually going to get to do this, but we're going to do it in the room where those guys did.
In
that very room. And I think about that sometimes where they took the time to go through line by line. They didn't just come in and, you know, one person had a proposal for an entire Constitution. Okay, let's just vote it up. No, they went through and looked at every line, every phrase meant something, everything that they put in the Constitution. They were taking a close look at
those
things.
Well, you know, one of the things that you cover is Franklin's call for prayer at the convention.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that happened was you had 13 nations that came to the Constitutional Convention. We think of them as states. No, they're nations. Just like Romania is different from Bulgaria, is different from Switzerland. And when they came in, they all had their own plans. You had the Virginia plan, you had the New York plan, you had the Connecticut plan, you had the New Jersey plan, and guess what? If you're from Georgia, you didn't want the New York plan. And if you're from New York, you didn't want the Virginia plan. And that was the problem they got into, and that's why it was falling apart, because they didn't come in with the written Constitution. They came in with their own separate agendas, and that's where Franklin says, guys, we got to get God in the middle of this, or this thing will fail, and future generations look back to this as an example of the futility of the wisdom of man. He said, we got to get God in this. So you're exactly right. When they got there, they didn't have mapped out in their mind everything. They came with agendas that they had to set aside, and they went for the common good, and in doing that, they came up with timeless principles that we still get to use today.
Let's go look at them one by one. We're headed back to Philadelphia to walk through Article 1, Section 8, and identify those enumerated powers of Congress.
So now that we see the big picture, we see seven articles, we see 27 amendments, let's zoom in to Article 1. Because it's here in Article 1 that we're going to discover the enumerated powers of Congress. What Congress is actually supposed to do. I call it the dues of Congress. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on all these other sections in Article 1. Y'all probably remember all this from government in high school. You know, our congressmen serve two-year terms. They got to be 25. Our senators serve six-year terms. They got to be 30. You get two from each state. Those basics, we're gonna leave aside for a moment. But let's dive into these very specific powers of Congress. And if you go to the end of Article 1, there are three sections there that we can focus on. It's the Section 8, 9, and 10, and it's the dues for Congress in 8. It's the don'ts for Congress in 9. And then it's the don'ts for the states in 10. And that actually confused me for a little bit when I started looking at it. And I'll be honest with you, I used to be confused by the 10th Amendment. I know, don't admit that, right? But I'm not a grammar guy. I'm a math guy, all right? So grammar confused me. Take a look at the 10th Amendment with me just for a second. This was always, this language threw me for a loop. Part of it was very obvious. But I also think the 10th Amendment is the best place to describe enumerated powers. And if you'll forgive my examples again, I'm going to go back to the buckets. Page 42 in the Constitution, in the original language, and page 43 in the Constitution Made Easy. These buckets of power that the Constitution sets up, okay? The 10th Amendment describes the three buckets. We have one bucket that are the powers that we, the people, have loaned to the federal government. Now, that bucket, friends, it has a lid on it. Congress cannot add power to itself. It only comes from us. So we created power for the federal government, and we put a lid on it. We put specific enumerated powers in there. And then the 10th Amendment describes the other two buckets. Here's what they are. So first you have your bucket where we've loaned power to government. It says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. So it's referring first to those powers delegated to the federal government by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectfully or to the people. So we have the bucket for the federal government, those prohibited by it to the states, and then those reserved to the people or the states. It's that middle phrase that confused me. Okay, I know it probably makes perfect sense to everybody else in the country, but for me, nor prohibited by it to the states, huh? What does nor prohibited by it to the states mean? If they had said nor prohibited by the Constitution to the states, I might have understood. But here's where I finally figured it out. When I went and looked at Section 10, Article 1, Section 10, the don'ts for Congress, and it went, ding, 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 I get it. Okay, so in the 10th Amendment, when it talked about things being prohibited for the states, that's what Article 1, Section 10 is. Some don'ts for Congress, for the states. Some things that we're going to take away from the states. And if you think about it, some of these just make sense. You don't want the states negotiating treaties with foreign nations. You got 50 different treaties with foreign nations. We want only the federal government to do that. So there's a list of things in Article 1, Section 10 the states are no longer allowed to do. And so we have our bucket of powers given to the federal government, our bucket of powers taken away from the states, nor prohibited by it to the states. That's that bucket. And that's, of course, things that will be in the bucket for the federal government. Everything else, it says, are reserved to the states respectfully or to the people. So if we didn't give that power to the government through our Constitution, through our representatives, if we didn't take it away from the states, man, everything else is ours. Everything else is left to the people and to the states. And that means that that lid is supposed to be secure and tight, and the only way you open that lid and put a new power in Congress's bucket is if we amend this document.
Article 5 is the only way to do it. That's why the 18th Amendment opened the lid, put a new power in, and then later with the 21st, we cracked that lid open, pulled some of that back, and then closed the lid again. Our problem today is that Congress has opened the lid on its own and is adding all kinds of powers and new departments and everything else that's not in Article 1, Section 8. And we the people are the ones that are going to have to put that lid back on. I would suggest taking some of those powers back before putting the lid on, but it's our job to get them back in their proper place. And so that's why we're going to look at what they're supposed to be doing. Article 1, Section 8. These are the enumerated powers of Congress. If it's not in here, they're not supposed to be doing it. If it's not in here, it's unconstitutional for them to be doing it. We have unconstitutional powers being executed by our federal government right now. They were never given the authority in the first place to do it. So we've got to rein them in. The only way we can rein them in is if we know what the proper powers are first. So let's look in that bucket and see what those powers are. First and right off the bat, as much as I don't like it, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes. All right, so they can. And of course, you've got to have the ability to do that. They can lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Why? To pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, here's a fundamental question. What does Congress have the power to tax for? What do they have the power to spend money on? This question was debated early by these guys, obviously, when they did the Constitution, and even within the first few decades, when people tried to start opening that lid and adding some powers for the federal government, others that had been part of the debate said, whoa, time out, I was there, you're not supposed to do that unless you amend the Constitution. So let's take a look at this phrase we already mentioned, general welfare. Now, general welfare today means I can pass anything in Congress I want because I'm helping the general welfare. I'm providing for the welfare of the people. And that tends to be the actions coming out of Washington, D.C. What did these guys say it was supposed to mean? Take a look there on your screen. When you look at the language in Article 1, Section 8, general welfare does not just suddenly appear by itself. There's no individual sentence that says, oh, federal Congress does anything that's for the general welfare of the people. It's in the context of this longer phrase that says what? To pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Interesting to me. When I started reading the debates of what they actually said and did here, when I started reading their commentaries, let's take Madison for instance. Madison tells us that during all those debates, general welfare wasn't even discussed until at the very end. It was a non-issue. It was in the Articles of Confederation talking about the states, the general welfare of the states, and throughout the convention, they ignored it. In fact, they had ignored something else throughout the convention. They hadn't talked about the debts of the Confederacy and how they were going to deal with that. And so right at the end, in a conversation dealing with the debts and how you pay for the debts, the phrase general welfare got inserted into this sentence. And here's where the conversation was going. They were saying, look, what's a proper tax for the federal government? What's a proper thing to spend money on? Well, obviously, if you go to war, you got to pay for that war. And it's the job of the nation, the federal government, to protect the system, the general welfare of the system, by fighting any foreign enemy. And almost always when you fight a war, you're going to run up some debt, right? You're going to have to borrow money to fight that war. And so what these guys said was if you did that and you ran up a debt, then as soon as that war was over, you should cut, tighten the belt, do whatever it takes to pay that debt off. And so many of the guys that sat in this room, either for the Constitution or the Declaration, gave us great quotes about the fact that if you carry debt over to the next generation, it's theft. That you're stealing from the next generation. If you borrow more in your generation than you can pay off, you have stolen from your children and your grandchildren. So get that stuff paid off. And so in the context of that mindset, these guys said, it's a proper function of the federal government to defend the nation, and then it's a proper function of the federal government to have taxes that they can raise the money to pay off those debts that were necessary to defend the nation. That was the context of this phrase. I find it quite interesting that they wanted you to be able to raise taxes to pay the debts so that you could protect the general welfare. And today, we run up the taxes and run up the debt to supposedly take care of the general welfare. We're really taking care of individual welfare, not general welfare. We're destroying the general welfare for somebody's individual welfare. We're running up the taxes and we're not even paying the debt. So we've got trillion-dollar debts that are hurting the general welfare instead of doing what these guys did. Now here's the problem. We talked earlier about original intent and phraseology. Even Madison himself talking about the how if you change the phraseology or the meaning of the phraseology to modern times, that would change the Constitution itself. Here's a better description. Let me give you Hamilton first. General welfare means different things to different people today. What we need to know is, what did it mean to these guys? Because what they meant by it is the meaning the Constitution today should still have. And actually,
no time today to finish that thought. Have a great Thanksgiving. Next Tuesday, we'll pick up with biblical citizenship in modern America. God bless. Thanks for listening to At the Core.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.